find the agenda on your computer.
My computer's updating, so.
All right, we'll wing it from there.
That's right.
So we will call the meeting to order. Pardon me. 101. And we, is there any general public comment? Hearing none. We will look to the April meeting minutes.
Move to approve.
Second.
We have a motion to approve and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Next, we have our staff report. Dusty, you're on.
It'll be short and sweet. We posted our meeting minutes, the May agenda, the May meeting details, and the May meeting details with the changes for the meeting. We uploaded all of our April video to Facebook and YouTube, so people can watch that. It's also on our website. And then I posted pictures of the CMU D51 COVID grant photos that they sent over with their grant. We didn't have any media to report on this time. And we have one grant payable. It's the Colorado Mesa University School District 51 COVID Rapid Test and Deployment Final Grant Payment. It's the $88,400. It was the full amount. And the pictures that they sent, you can see they've got the plaque up there. And they're around the machine. And then they sent in some, you know, pictures of them doing tests. And then the more testing of the tests that they implemented. So they put it to use immediately and used it.
They got some media in the New York Times on that. Did you see that? Yeah. There was an article about
amazing piece.
About the program that they've instituted for water testing.
Yeah, with that.
In New York Times of all places.
Yeah, it was good. We have our April invoices. Dusty Reimer invoice 158 for $2,690.98. Ide Bailey invoice EI01138601 for services for $505.43. And Dufford Waldeck invoice for $228 for legal services. Our upcoming events, just want to touch base on the June board meeting date is June 16th. Just in case schedules might be weird.
Never moved to board meeting.
Never.
No.
I know. I just annoyingly throw it out there as content.
Difficult or something?
Irresponsible of us to do that. Okay. June what?
16th. I know we're getting into summer.
It works for me.
Okay.
Yes.
I've got too many things going on that day. Okay. Looks good.
Okay. Perfect. July is on there for the 21st, and then our audits, it's almost done. I'm shocked, actually. It's probably the quickest it's ever been done. I touched base with Willie yesterday. We sent in a few things. I think Matt and Chris, you'll be getting a letter done from him, from us, and then he'll have a draft ready. We'll do our MD&A, and then we should be ready to present to you guys potentially by June. Have it all approved and sent over to the state before July 31st.
That's okay.
So, yeah. So that's my staff report.
Okay. Is there a motion to approve the staff report and invoices?
So moved.
Second.
A motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed?
All right.
Let's move on to our financials.
Okay. Kind of the same thing, nothing too glamorous. Our total bank balance was $924,868.15. Permanent fund ending April 30th showed $2,117,929.35. Our invoices were paid for accounting fees and contract services, our dues and memberships. Our grants were still showing, but now Colorado Mesa University this next time will show paid off, so we'll have three outstanding with City of Fruta, Grand Junction Police Department, and Lower Valley Fire Protection District. And our budget to actual, same thing, not a whole lot has changed.
Okay.
Pretty quiet.
Anybody have any questions on the financials?
Do you want a motion to approve those?
Yes, please.
I move to approve the financials as presented.
Second.
A motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay.
Motion, all those, any opposed? Motion carried. And thank you, Craig, for prompting me there. I was looking at my notes.
Well, I think Chris told us we didn't have to do that unless we just felt like moving in second.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it depends on if there's a concern.
It always seems like the financials, it's hard not to approve the financials, isn't it?
It's sort of like, we'll take it for what it's worth. You know, maybe it's right, maybe it's not. I mean, when you are approving it, you're saying you have reason to believe everything's accurate.
It's the banker in me wants to approve the financials. Okay. Review of our investment account?
Yeah, so I got you guys hard copies, and I'll flip pages pretty quickly in the interest of time, but if there's questions, we can just,
okay,
just stop in, having to discuss whatever's on the mind. First page is, I think, page 4 on your books, but it just shows that green graph. Basically, the current balance, this is as of market close last Friday. I think the two things I'd point out are the total gain is actually really good since inception, $527,000. And then the investment policy asks for a comparative benchmark, which isn't something I actually pay a lot of attention to. Benchmarks have a lot of issues with them, and, but it is good from time to time to look at that. So this shows kind of the annual and since inception returns compared to the benchmark of the portfolio. That benchmark is a 55% equity, 45% bond benchmark, which is a moderate risk target. And so I think we've outperformed that. That's not the goal of an advisor in marketing, that's not the job, but the reason why is basically we've been sitting at a higher equity allocation pretty much since inception. We did a rebalance for you guys in March last year, so it was March 12th through 17th. We rebalanced the portfolio, which turned out to be about a week from the absolute bottom, and that's where we bought into more stock and sold off bonds when the stock was down. And so that was a really nice boost to the portfolio. And then we've also been a little more strategic with our bonds than our bond indexes. So one of the changes we made, for example, was in March of last year, again, is to get the treasuries out of the portfolio as much as possible. So we used to own an aggregate bond fund. If you look at any aggregate bond fund, that's gonna be about 40-45% treasuries. And so what I was saying is I don't really want any treasuries in a portfolio after, you know, that kind of March, April of last year. So basically replicated those bond sectors by finding the sector funds and not the ag to get that out of the portfolio. And that's caused for some outperformance. I don't think, you know, month to month or even quarter to quarter we're picking and choosing, trying to find winners. It's mostly passive. The next page just shows the income of the portfolio. So it's about a 1.5% yield, which is, you know, 31 to 32,000 is kind of what we're expecting for this year. You have a couple benchmark yields there. The S&P is 1.35 with the 10-year treasury currently 1.63. And then the thing I know I'd like to pay attention to is the duration of the bond portfolio, which is 2.6 years, is really short, considering what's out there. So this just shows the some more portfolio attributes. Last one, next page 6, has the standard deviation, which is the risk. I highlighted that in red. Oh, sorry, I'm not switching.
Yeah, I was trying to follow on.
So standard deviation is the volatility of the portfolio. It's how a measure of risk. So we have 10.3%, which is right on par with a moderate risk target. And then that shows the IRR of the portfolio too at 10.8. This just shows the asset class breakout of each of those as well. I think that 10.3% standard deviation is something we'll talk about here in a second, because in your IPS, you actually reference a 15% risk, and I think that's one of the things that might add clarity on if we're gonna make changes to the FPS. So keep that one in mind. The next slide is really the most important slide, I think, when you're evaluating portfolio management, which is shows the scatter plot. Let's see, right here. And on your left axis is the return of the portfolio, your vertical axis, and then on the bottom axis is the risk. And so what you're doing is, you know, returns are all relative to the risk incurred to get those returns. And as you move from a very conservative portfolio to moderate to very aggressive, the return should be higher, but you're also incurring more risk. And you end up with sort of a curve or a line that you could draw that slopes to the northeast on this graph that says, okay, we're basically getting the amount of return we should for how much risk we're taking. And this, I think, is shows that we've done a good job of that, because that green square is your portfolio, and you can see there's, you know, there's definitely higher return above that, but there's not any higher return that's also to the left of that, which would mean it was done with more risk, right? And so we have that balanced right in the moderate, where it should be, which is the combination of those asset classes, and we're right on that efficient frontier. So I feel pretty good about that. I guess what would be not good would maybe be if that, say that green, box were down to the southeast there, you know, below the circle, like lower than the circle, that would be bad, right? Because now you took more risk, but you got less return than that asset class. So, so I like this chart, and it's one I look at quarter. I do look at that regularly to make sure we're staying there. The next slide is just asset allocation. So we're currently at 62% equity, which would imply about 48% bond. Our IPS restricts us to 65. We actually got above 65 for a while. So I had to, I say unfortunately, because equities have gone up since then. So I rebalanced to get back to 60, and then we've drifted back up to 62. We've come close to getting back up there, but now we're a little bit off the highs. So we're currently at 62, and I like that. I probably will leave that there, and if it floats higher than 65 again, we'll rebalance. If there's a sell-off of some sort, I would do another rebalance. Last slide I have on just the portfolio parameters and stuff is the fees, and make sure those are transparent disclosed. Our fee is 0.8%. The additional fees, where am I going? The additional fees to the portfolio are about 0.075, which are the fund expenses. And so your total portfolio fees are about 8.87, which I think is right in line with market for investment advisory services. So that's the portfolio in a nutshell. And then I have some slides on economic updates, things we're looking at going forward. And then the last section is on kind of my thoughts on your current investment policy statement and investment parameters. But I'll pause to answer any questions, maybe just about the portfolio if there are any. Good?
Yeah, all right. That's good.
Okay, so economic update is, I'll try to keep it high level. I mean, you guys read the news, New York Times, I never would have expected. the market, if you're talking about stocks or the value of any security is basically a supply and a demand, right? And so in order, I hear this all the time, like, oh, things have got to come down. This is crazy. And I think I never want to just say yes, absolutely, because there has to be half of the people saying, no, I want to buy in right now, right? So if I'm going to make some sort of judgment on why is this wrong, I want to be able to say why one of the half is wrong, right? Half the people are buying, half the people are selling, and that's where the price is, where it is. And so I'll start with kind of what I think are the things that could cause the market to go down here in the next, you know, for I guess, the rest of the year. Clicker. There we go. The first was the news that came out a couple weeks ago, and that was that payroll data, where unemployment actually ticked up, which was a little surprising considering we're coming out of pandemic phase. But then the most alarming was the jobs report payroll numbers, which we were expecting 1 million new payrolls added and only 260,000. So that was a huge miss. And that sent the market, that's kind of where the volatility's come from the last couple of weeks. Most of those were, including 18,000 of them in manufacturing. So this is a theme you guys are probably familiar with, but it's basically it's people are being paid not to work right now, and it's gonna be hard to fill those jobs. So that's gonna be, I guess I've never seen this before, and
did you know what the governor's doing today?
$600
to go to work?
I'll leave my opinion out of it. But that's interesting. I mean, how are we gonna get the jobs filled when they make more money not working, right? And I think there's the plan to eventually taper out of that, say over the next 3 or 4 months. But I don't know, I mean, do people just say, oh, okay, now I'll go back to work? And then we have a lot of backlog now, especially again in manufacturing and shipping and transportation and stuff like that. So how is all that backlog gonna get worked through? Kind of remains to be seen. And I think that's why I have this as a risk to the market on here. The second one there is this government transfer payments, which is kind of the same thing, where right now you have 40% of personal income is basically government transfer payments. That was super alarming to me.
40%?
Like 40%, yeah. So 40% of our total income is government transfer payments. And actually, I looked up the definition of government transfer payments before I came in here because I wanted to make sure I knew that. And it's very simple. It's just the government paying for this something they don't receive a good or service for. So there's here's money. And so that's now 40% of incomes, which is, how do you get down from that? So if you see that graph. So that's another risk. And then the third risk I have is probably not as significant, because we've been through this before, which is the tax hikes, the increases in taxes proposed. And those haven't passed yet. I put two slides on here that talk about some of the major ones, and we can discuss those if we want. The one that would be most relevant for our discussion is the top one, the corporate income tax, increasing that from 21 to 28, and then putting all kinds of penalties and stuff on the companies who are keeping stuff overseas to try to avoid that. The last time, when Trump lowered the tax rate from 35 to 21, we got about a 10% bump in the stock market, like right away. Mm-hmm. So I think, this wouldn't be going back to 35. I mean, my expectation would be if this corporate tax one passes to see, probably a 7 to 8% stock market immediate decline as a result. But that would also probably be like a temporary, in just 1 year. So those are why I think there's some risks. The positives, though, or why I say it's not like I would just go selling everything automatically, is increased money supply. So this graph, page 15, shows the M2 money supply in the U.S., and that is hard to read up there, but if you look at it, it's increased a ton from 2020 till now, and that's about a 30% increase. If you see where it was just smooth up, and then all of a sudden, pow, it shoots up and starts going off its historical path. That's from just the stimulus. So you have, I guess another way to say that is if you took a dollar out of your pocket, 30 cents of that was printed in the last 15 months. And so we've really injected a lot of money supply into the system. This is not including the $2.25 trillion infrastructure and transportation bill that is up for consideration right now. So if we add that in, you're gonna obviously see this go up even more. The next page is the outcome of that is inflation. There's more money in the room. So this next page is the other kind of positive, is that household savings is pretty much at all-time highs right now. So historically, household saving rates around 13%. It's been as low as six, or I guess in certain short periods of time, zero. But now you can see these numbers are pretty high. So good news is people are reducing debt, and then there's all this pent up investment savings that when things open up, maybe could really cause the economy to start going like gangbusters even more. Those are kind of the positives. So I put two slides in here on gold and Bitcoin. We don't have to discuss those, but I do always get questions on them, so they're there. And I think the interesting thing, and this will lead me into the IPS and portfolio discussion, is the yield, our blended yield on the bond portion of our portfolio is around 2%. And if the projections are for 2.6% annual inflation, at least for the next 5 years, right? So you could look at that 40% of our, 38% of our portfolio and say this is gonna get a negative real return over the next 5 years, at best, right? And so bonds have really gone from being a source of income and yield to a portfolio to really just a store of value. And there's a cost to that store of value now, it would seem. So. So I guess you can see where I'm going with that, and that's that that I think we should be looking at increasing the stock allocation to our portfolio, especially considering the goals of the district. And before I get into that, though, I'll pause again to make sure there's no more questions on just kind of economic data. A lot. Sorry to fly through, and I can talk fast. So, okay. So my recommendations then, as we look at the portfolio going forward, are at least to stay at right around our maximum equity allocation, keep the duration of the bonds short, and one of the things I think we could look at is something we've talked about in the past, but it's, if you look at the S&P 500, or say we're using index funds for the total allocation of equity, the dispersion of, characteristics of stocks within that is really broad, though. So in the S&P 500, you now have Tesla, which is trading at 530 times earnings and 17 times sales. I mean, that's a crazy number. And then you have companies like Chevron, who are 2x sales, and Xcel Energy. And so I think if we just go in with a total market, here's the index now, which is what we've done, and I love that approach for a long time. What's a good way to say it? I'm having to drink everything, right? I don't get to pick and choose. And I think if we can customize that equity sector a little, or equity allocation more, we can get it that's more appropriate for the goals of the district, which would be obviously right now more energy, more utilities, materials and industrials, and less tech, consumer discretionary. And even within those sectors, you have the ability to, there's just broad dispersion, right? I mean, within consumer discretionary, you have the casinos and the cruise ships, but then you have like a company like Apple. So we can really kind of refine how we want that portfolio to fit the goals, rather than have to just kind of take it all with a big broad swoop. So those are my recommendations on the portfolio, but the IPS specifically, if I go to that financial plan review, so now I'm on page 22. This is a chart we did, I want to say right when we started several years ago, but it's basically a Monte Carlo simulation, and we were trying to say, okay, what's our goal here with creating this, this permanent fund? And I think the board at the time said, I think, let's say to get $1 million that we can send out every year without having to worry about significant principal reduction, right? And at the time, yields were obviously higher. Right now, there's a 1.5% dividend and interest yield on the portfolio, which would imply it we would need $66 million before we could say, let's send $1 million out that's just dividends and interest. But you're also going to have a growth component of that too. So I think a safe withdrawal rate is still going to be 4 or 5%, where you can send that out every year, knowing that you're going to pretty much be endowed still. That implies, you know, 23 to 25 million is where the portfolio needs to get to. But the thing I'm focused on is, if we truly want to stay in perpetuity, we want to be an endowment, then we're way under allocated in equities. And I think you really should be almost all equities if that's the case. And that also fits with kind of the investment outlook I had as well. I know there's more fluctuation involved with that, but that's where the long-term inflation hedge is going to come from, and the growth. And so when you look at the endowments and foundations that are permanently endowed already, they're very, very heavy equity. They are almost all equity. The only thing they would do, I guess, differentiate is alternative assets, where they would claim like hedge funds, direct investments, and stuff like that is about a 30% allocation. So the traditional like Yale endowment model is 70% equities, 30% alternatives, but pretty much no bonds, except for like cash management stuff. So I think that's worth discussion. Is this still our goal, to get to that $1 million? If so, is it your goal still to be endowed, or I guess be a perpetual investor? If that's the case, now page 23, this is the Colorado statutes 2451206 that limits the 65% equities. That's the one I would recommend changing. There's this other clause I highlighted in the bottom, and that was just the one that I think needs some clarifying, because establish an annual risk tolerance for unrealized losses to be less than 15%. And so originally I interpreted that as a kind of a 15% annualized standard deviation was the goal, right? Less than that. And we've definitely stayed below that. In fact, a moderate portfolio is usually going to be around 7 to 8%. We're at 10, and it's only because of the craziness of March and April of last year, where we had some days that were 10% and 12% single equity movement days. But if this were to be interpreted as there's a 15% drawdown, right? So in other words, like, we don't want the portfolio to ever go down more than 15%, maybe from its previous at high watermark. That would have implied we would have had to sell out of everything at the bottom, right? And I think that's a risk that we don't want to take, that we have some stop loss that says you have to sell now, and it calls us out of the market. So I think that's worth clarifying. My last comment, and I'm done, is on the investment policy statement in general. And Chris is gonna love this, but an investment policy statement is just basically guidelines for what are we doing here, what's our goal, you know, what's okay, what's not, what kind of risk do we want. And I think we've legalized this to some extent too much, where we have Colorado statutes listed in there that are saying, okay, we have to be bound by this. And I think that runs the risk to both of us, honestly, the board and to me as an investment advisor, of getting caught in some, you know, minor state statute thing that's old, like railroad equipment trust certificates and stuff, that wasn't really intended to be part of what we're trying to do. And plus those change, and it's not something that's, you know, always made publicly available, like, oh, this rule changed. So I guess making the investment policy statement a little more just plain English is the recommendation. And we can help with that.
So, a couple questions for you, Matt.
Yes, sir.
25% of this portfolio is in international bonds and stocks. There's a dual risk factor there. You can be right, you can still be wrong. Why is a federal mineral leasing district in Mesa County, Colorado, taking those two risks? Do you understand what I'm saying by the dual risk?
Mm-hmm. I think I do, but can you tell me just so I
can Okay, so you can say, well, international equities are at a discount compared to U.S. equities. So theoretically, there's value there. But also, those international securities are valued in their home currencies. They're not valued in dollars. So you can be right about the movement of those markets, but if the currency moves against you, you're still wrong. At the end of the day, yield is an opinion, cash is a fact. So at the end of the day, you're right that they were undervalued, but the cash you receive back off the portfolio doesn't reflect that because of the risk that you're taking with those currencies. I struggle with that.
Yeah, so that's a really common concern that we hear, right? Not just with institutional clients, but just individuals a lot. Like, why am I invested in this other country? And part of what we're trying to do to stay on that efficient frontier, if you go back to that scatter plot page, right, is you have to create a globally diversified portfolio that that covers all those different asset classes. And the reason you want to do that is the correlations between the two. So they both have positive returns, right? But there's the possibility that, even though one of them's up 10%, the other's up 12%, and you're going to hedge, you're basically reducing total portfolio risk by diversifying like that. The local currency thing, it's funny, most of the ETFs that are issuing like country-specific funds, so say I wanted a Canada ETF or a Switzerland ETF, they're doing them on a dollar hedge basis because it sounds good to say like I want dollar exposure to this country. But the reason you invest internationally is part of that currency exposure, right? So when I have my probability distribution of returns for a US stock, it's based on profits and performance and stuff like that. When I have an international stock, I have essentially a broader dispersion because now I have profits and performance, but I also have the exchange rate relationship with the dollar, right? And even though that sounds like a bad thing, that's adding that diversity to my portfolio. That's giving me a lower risk, lower standard deviation for the same return. The other thing is the exchange rate difference, like what influences that, right, is the differential between interest rates and inflation between the two countries. So when a country like ours starts going gangbusters printing cash, that's not to say the others aren't going to as well, but that's actually going to bring down the dollar, strengthen the international holdings. So on my outlook, I would feel favorable specifically about the emerging market equities because they don't have the ability to do what we're doing. And like you're going to see the euro and all the others do is just start flooding their economies. So the long answer, that's a long answer, but the short answer is it's part of adding diversification to the portfolio. It's not reducing the return, and that's what's keeping us on that curve. One more thing, though, that I think is worth mentioning is the fixed income piece. That's one bond fund. The ticker is JPST, and that's 70% U.S. bonds and 30% developed market bonds like Canada and stuff like that. Those, if it's below 80%, we classify it as an international security. So even though that's international, it's 70% U.S. So that's an investment restriction that you guys are free to say we don't want international securities in the portfolio, but I would not recommend it. Yeah, and we will follow that. We've had clients say that.
By many metrics, we are in rarefied air with U.S. stock prices. And you're asking us to increase our purchases of stocks, the allocation portfolio, at what arguably could be the top. Correct?
Yeah. Well, I actually
it's up the top forever.
Right.
But.
And I think there's an approach we can take to do that strategically. So I don't think tomorrow, if you said do that, I'm gonna go sell all the bonds and buy into the stock market. But yeah, I mean, if we're really a permanent investor, right? Then why are we sitting in bonds that are going to have a negative real return over the next 5 years with all probability, right? I would think if you're not touching this money, then it should be in stocks. Like my retirement, I mean, I'm going to retire for another 20-something years, and I can't take out of that retirement account for 20 years. So I have it all in stocks, 100% of it, 99.7% because you get 3%, 0.3% cash. But that's stocks. And I have to have the stomach to watch the market go down like it did in March 2020 and just be like, I'm not touching this, so whatever. And in fact, if you're like me, where you're saving, or you guys actually, where you're potentially getting more contributions in, you should smile on a market that goes down like that. You're like, phew, finally, we don't have to take our new money and buy in at these crazy multiples.
So you're saying that 65% is not enough. What is enough? You're recommending that we change that, but I'm not seeing what you want to change to.
Well, I think the first thing before you go there is to recommit to your goal of being a perpetual investor, right? Like saying, yes, this is true. We want these funds to last forever, and we're not concerned with the volatility, right? And I think that was the comment when we founded that graph, so, you know, 3 years ago, but I still feel like there maybe is some nervousness of if the market were to, you know, collapse, how is this going to be looked at politically, right? For us taking these funds when we could have distributed those out. And so I think easing into that was a good approach. But I think there's more comfort now with that, right? We have some margin of profits in there. And so I think that is the right move. But if that's the right move, then it's to go pretty much all, you know, 95, 97% equities. Because those are gonna get the returns. That's the inflation hedge. And if you're not gonna touch that money, that's where it goes. One more comment though is the fear of I guess for my clients that are personal, it's just an emotional cost to see their account go down, even if they aren't ever gonna take that money out, right? For my institutional clients, it's a political cost because you have a board of directors who has a fiduciary responsibility to this and says, somebody's gonna criticize us for doing this if this happens. And that's real. And I don't think it should be discounted. So I'm not able to give that opinion, but if that is real, then it is, and we keep it where it is. Yeah. So just like I have clients who, I'm never gonna need this money, but when I watch it go down by X percent, it causes me to almost have a heart attack. And that's real. We need to keep it more conservative if that's the case. Yeah. And these are discussion items too, it's not.
Sure.
Yeah.
In my line of work, every disaster that I've witnessed goes back to one thing: a lack of diversification. Did you really do that? Did you? And like I said, that's just an observation from many years of doing what I do. That when I see a disaster, it's a lack of diversification that gets it. And it gets them every time.
agreed. They're saying every great fortune that's ever been created was from wealth concentration. Every great fortune that's ever been lost was from wealth concentration. Right? diversification, though, in terms of your portfolio, I'll say if we're looking at just the stock portion alone, even right now, there's two funds or three funds, but between those three, there's basically every stock in the U.S. stock market. 4,000 stocks you have in there.
Those are all in S&P mutual funds?
No, because the S&P index is 500. So the biggest ones that I believe the Vanguard Total Market Fund, which is 3,500 stocks. Mm-hmm. So that's a much broader index. Yeah, you do have a large cap fund in there, and we've concentrated a little more on large cap, which has worked out well too. But that's is diversified. Even though there's, you know, say 12 holdings in that portfolio, not including the individual bonds we have, you are as diversified as you could possibly be. The only thing we don't have, pardon me, is currencies and commodities. And that's the gold slide. I put that in there. It's, I don't think, again, gold, commodities aren't appropriate for long-term investors.
But you're probably sunk into commodity stocks at some point. If you're, if your index covers the S&P
the total fund. Commodity stock?
Yeah, Newmont Mining or you know, mining company stocks.
Well, yeah. So there's a big difference between those, right? Because you have a company that produces a product and sells it, and yes, their profits are going to be tied to the price of that commodity, but that's still a stock to me. It's not a commodity is like what you trade with futures contracts, where you're just buying the pure commodity itself.
Yeah.
And in a portfolio like ours, we can't take possession of even gold or corn or hogs.
Companies with commodity risk, but it's not that.
Yeah, and
I already know that those would be legal investments under our statutory
illegal
scheme.
The futures.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you run into contango, which is the futures price you're buying is much higher than the spot, and you end up with a real negative, expected negative return from investing in commodities. So that's why for long term, you would never want to buy a commodities fund, even if it's in your personal accounts, and say, I'm going to own this for 30 years. If you're buying it, you're probably doing it for maybe a 6 month. Yeah, like I think this is going to happen, and it's basically speculative at that point, which is something people like to do, speculate in there.
What's your bet on the economy?
I feel really negative, except for like I always hear Warren Buffett in my ear saying, "Don't bet against America." So it's maybe a little sentimental, but I don't want to bet against America, and so. Like I said, I'm 100% stocks in my portfolio. I'm a long-term investor, and even though I feel like we're definitely in uncharted territories, it's not the first time we've been there. And no matter how much I disagree with certain things that are going on right now, there's another election coming up. I shouldn't have said that. Did I say that out loud?
There's always another one.
Yeah, we'll have a... And we have freedom still, so yeah, I don't want to bet against America.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions?
I don't. Thank you.
So, if it's okay, I provided you guys with just sort of a handout on the statutory scheme that applies to your decision making, it's really for informational purposes. I think most of what's in there you already know, in the sense that the board acts as a fiduciary. It's got a duty to weigh risks. It's got a duty to diversify as appropriate. It's got a duty to consider costs, investment costs, and it's got a duty to make broad decisions about parameters. You can delegate a lot of those functions to your investment advisor, but ultimately the buck stops with the board. The statutory scheme is laid out in the Mineral Leasing or Federal Mineral Leasing District Act, which in turn incorporates the provisions of the Uniform Prudent Investor Act, which kind of sets the duties for trustees of funds generally, and then this para overlay, which was crafted into the legislation, if you'll recall, when the legislature enacted the law allowing us to invest, they wanted to put some guardrails and they were trying to figure out what are appropriate investment vehicles for a district like this. And they were looking for other models and they settled on what the para board is authorized to invest in. And I've summarized what those things are. And some of them are kind of anachronistic, as Matt pointed out. Some of them don't really seem like current investments that you would consider. It also includes some things that are kind of strange, in my opinion, things like investments in real estate, for example. We're allowed to do that. Should we do that? Probably not. I don't know. I mean, you know, real estate's at an all-time high right now. But
it's because a lot of organizations get real estate gifted to them. And
exactly. Yeah, that's right. So I wanted to provide that to you just so that you kind of know the guardrails, broadly speaking. I think our policy is pretty well crafted and it has served us well. I think it checks off the boxes in terms of, you know, fiduciary standards and periodic review and review of expenditures, and we do actually more than what the state law requires in the sense that Matt is here not every month but almost every month frequently to brief us on performance, and if he's not here we've got the statements from ROSCAP. So that you guys have a very hands-on approach to looking at what things are what your portfolio is doing. And I agree with the comment that we are sort of an indefinite duration investor, like any other endowment at a big institution. But our money is more like an oversized IRA right now. But we do have some limitations on how aggressive you can be in terms of your investments. And that 65% figure on equities, it's hard-boiled into the statute. And so if we want to become more aggressive on that, it might require a legislative change. And that's something that is doable, but it's not doable in the short term. There was one other thing in my note that, you know, there is a provision in the law that says that trustees, meaning you as board members, you have to make reasonable efforts to verify the facts and relevant information. This is sort of the Bernie Madoff provision, for lack of a better term, in the sense that you're not just taking the word of your advisors, but you're actually going out and verifying things. So that means it puts a duty of inquiry on you in terms of verifying that the returns are there, that the account balances are correct, that the securities are held, those types of things. So, you know, this investment policy, there was a lot in it. I might respectfully differ a little bit with Matt on some of this, is that we have some limitations on what we can do that are hard baked into our policy by law. And so, you know, that 65% limitation is one of those things. And so given the current state of investments, yeah, it might be prudent to sink more money into stocks, like most investors are doing these days. But legally, I think we can't do that, and so we have to respect that. But then within that discretion that there's a great deal of flexibility you have as to what you want to invest in. There are no limitations on investing in overseas equities, for example. But you may, for a variety of reasons, conclude that that's maybe not an appropriate area in your portfolio that you want to focus on or that you want to be invested in. What I was thinking about today when we talked about this is for you guys to think about your policy and what you would like to change and kind of give direction to us and to Matt, because it's an opportune time to kind of look at, are we needing to change our direction, you know, rebalance, to use that term, or give more direction to Matt as to how that money is invested. So, and I'm glad to answer questions too if you have any.
We made a decision today.
I don't think you have to make a decision today. I think this is really just a briefing thing. And I would encourage, if you guys have input, we would probably need to put that into a written policy and bring it back to you for approval. Mm-hmm.
Maybe ask for comment, email comments, midway between now and the next meeting?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of doing business and even with emails, but...
Email that would be brought forward in the meeting.
In other words, give it some direction about, hey, you know, if you could add this to the policy or change this, and we bring it back to you to consider.
And then we could just some emails for thought, and then we can discuss those.
Okay.
And then not to handle business outside of this, but some direction.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Sounds good to me. Good job.
Thank you. All right, thank you,
Jeff.
Let's see, on this, we don't really need to take action.
No.
We'll discuss this. I think we're pretty, you know, unfortunately, you know, I've dealt with with other money that has had these constraints on it, and we don't have a lot of choice as far as I'm concerned, you know, as far as the, the para overlay and the requirements. If this were my personal investments, I would do something differently, but given our duties here, we don't have a whole lot of choice. But let's, if we have some, I'll put out, if you'll remind me, Dusty, I'll send out a, as let everybody review this stuff, and we'll request some comments, and then we'll have a discussion on that in the next meeting.
Perfect.
See if there's any changes we want to make. Okay. All right. Is there anything else we want to do? Thank you, Matt, for your time,
yes, sir,
and your insight on that. Do we have any unscheduled business? Okay.
I move to adjourn.
I'll second that. All in favor of adjourning?
Yeah.
Aye. Aye. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, guys.
Absolutely.
I always learn
meeting
a lot
adjourned at 1:52.
Presentation.